more important than ever. Students at Vancouver Island University's Culinary Arts School created a 70-foot-long Nanaimo bar, which now holds the world record. Lauren McKenzie at CHLY was there to witness this culinary feat. Scientists at the University of British Columbia in Victoria have now tracked the first Chinook from its hatchery 1,000 kilometers away as part of a migration project. Pam Hassan at CICK News in Smithers brings us that story. I'm Dan Messick, and you're listening to The Scoop.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. During this year's National Nursing Week, the British Columbia's Nurses Union, or BCNU, has been spreading the word on the Ratios Save Lives campaign. This campaign advocates for better nurse-to-patient ratios, improved working conditions, and higher nurse retention in BC. While the provincial government has put their support behind this campaign, there is still a shortage of nurses within the province. Recently, CJSF spoke with Tristan Newby, the vice president of the BCNU, on the work that the union says still needs to be done to attain the ideal nurse-to-patient ratio in BC, as well as how different levels of government can work together to attain this goal for the province. Please take a listen.
Ratio Saves Lives campaign is a public awareness as well as a member awareness campaign to really socialize the concept that minimum to nurse patient ratios within the hospital setting and within healthcare more broadly not only saves the lives of patients, but it also saves the system a considerable amount of money when you look at what we're ending up paying out in overtime for private agencies. Once you have established minimum nurse-patient ratios, the likelihood of mortality and morbidity of patients decreases. And it is within jurisdictions that have rolled these out, I'm specifically calling out California, Oregon, New South Wales, you see an increased investment in nurses elongating their careers, having more satisfaction, and decreased incidences of violence within healthcare settings.
Where is the progress on it right now? I know the province has put forward their support on this movement, but that was a few months ago now. So where do you think things are heading at the moment?
So back in March of 2024, as well as September of 2024, the provincial government announced what had been negotiated and agreed to. An example of that is if you are presented to a general medical ward within a hospital, you should see that your nurse has no more than four patients assigned to them. So that negotiation took about a year to get to. And then once we had the newly formed government, there is within the Minister of Health's mandate is to advance minimum nurse patient ratios. Where the lag is, so is within the operationalizing of it. So each of the health authorities have been provided, here is your mandate. You need to meet these ratios. And then the health authorities now have a period of time to be able to get to a point where they have these lines created and they have people posting into them. That is where we're finding that there's some delays. So it is an unrealistic expectation that right now that if I go into hospital, I will see, you know, a 1-to-4 ratio. But that is the intention over the course of, you know, the next year or so.
So one of the things that brought this campaign to my attention was that one of your lobby coordinators in the Simon Fraser region presented on the nurse to patient ratio movement at New Westminster City Council. And I'm wondering what your perspective is on what municipal governments throughout the Lower Mainland and throughout BC in general, what role they play in supporting.
Yeah, thanks. So Melissa and I work together. So I'm the provincial lobby coordinator within British Columbia, and the Simon Fraser region is actually my home turf. So The 2025, one of our main initiatives was conceptualizing the idea of ratios to folks. And we know that what we, once these, our government has committed to their implementation. But along that process, we need to ensure that the general public as a whole is, has an understanding of what ratios are. And what's involved in establishing ratios goes far beyond, you know, the Minister of Health making some announcement about, look how it, how great it is. You've got 1 to 3 here, 1 to 4 there. And there will also come a time where we need to turn our mind to how are we enforcing these ratios? And that, for that, we really need to ensure that we have an engaged and informed public, because this is about your health, your publicly provided health care. And if we need people to know that above the 1 to 4 ratio, people have a 12 to 16% chance of being injured or suffering some event in the hospital for every patient that a nurse has above the established ratios. And I think that the general public as of right now believes that these ratios are already in place, which isn't in fact the reality. Specifically to your question though, what we're looking at within the municipalities is that these folks are really the most closely aligned with their constituents, and they're making decisions about building communities. And what we're looking for is raising their awareness of the impact, the positive impact that ratios can have within a community, and how we can be finding opportunities to partner with each other to advance the building of these municipalities, communities, so that it attracts young healthcare professionals that are going to choose to plant their roots and raise their families here. And this is really has the potential to be a symbiotic relationship, and as far as advancing this, both from the nurses, the public, and from municipal level governments.
This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. In 2011, the Moose Hide campaign was co-founded by Paul Lassert and his daughter Raven Lassert, with an intention of inviting men everywhere to recognize and understand their role in participating in ending violence against women and children, and even each other. You might notice people year-round wearing small squares of animal hide pinned to their jacket, their shirt, hat, or clothing. From humble grassroots beginnings, by now, this movement, encouraged by Indigenous and non-Indigenous men, has steadily gained participation all over Canada. On Thursday, May 15th, an event was held at the College of New Caledonia outdoors on what was expected to be a chilly, overcast spring day, but turned out to be radiant and well-attended. We caught up with this year's CNC event coordinator, Michael Antoine, Indigenous Holistic Support Worker at the college's ARC, or Aboriginal Resource Center.
Why do you feel it was important to participate in the Moose Hide campaign this year? Maybe the gravity is specific around this event compared to years past or maybe years ahead.
I think we had an amazing group of people participating. I had students speak today. I had faculty speak today. I had the president of college speak today. I also had our elder, Darlene McIntosh, speak today. So that gives a broad range of perspectives, right? I don't like to make things all about me. It's about all of us as a community, right? And that those changes need to be made specifically with Indigenous men. That was kind of the focus today, but I'm very inclusive. Women are taking on men's roles today. They're becoming our chiefs. They're becoming our counselors. They're becoming heads of big organizations. They're becoming heads in education. And anytime I participated in any meetings and any role that I've played in the past, more often than not, I'm the only man present. And I started to look when I started to work in the jails and I started to work in the school district and work with foster care children. I started to see a trend that our men, Indigenous men, are out doing things that they shouldn't be doing. They're not present. They're in jails. They're in addiction or alcoholism. And as much as I hate to say it, it's the reality today. So it's up to me and many men like me that are taking a spiritual journey and healthy elders to help break that cycle and to create those warriors again. So if I can get them when they're young and pass on those perspectives and that knowledge and with the elders, the wisdom, we could start to break that cycle and start to protect our women and our children and our elders and our future generations.
CNC student Michael Morgan shared with the crowd and then with us part of his own personal journey in recognizing his own past mistakes and setting a new course towards healing.
I just know that one day I was tired of disrespecting women and children, not knowing how to overcome that. And I had to have a life change. In order to do that, I had to learn how to respect myself and then learn about my behavior, attitude, and my beliefs, and slowly make the change to adapted to honoring and respecting women and children as myself.
Michael Morgan, along with many other men and women, were both brave and vulnerable to come to the center stage and share incredibly personal stories to help everyone in attendance find their own ways to heal and help address the issue of violence against women and children. We return to Michael Antoine to ask him, as a coordinator of this type of event, how he prepares to properly engage with an event that requires well-tuned sensitivity and an open mind, among many other skills.
The Moosehide Campaign, it's an event that was created fairly locally here, and now the traction has really picked up. It's across the country. As far as I know, it's actually extended to the United States as well to some degree. But the message in the core of it, it's open to men, women, children. It's multi-generational. It's all ages. But the focus is to invite men in to acknowledge the male role, our role, in perpetrating violence and intervening in that is at the center, but doing it not necessarily in a shame-based method where people are able to come to these events, participate in the Moosehide Campaign without the fear of essentially being browbeaten over being a man. And what does it mean to be able to open that door to this kind of event and bring people in with the acknowledgement that we all make mistakes and we come from places that aren't perfect. We wear these imperfections, but can ultimately come to address them. Do you have a stance from which you're able to keep that door open and bring people in and meet people where they're at?
Well, when I started a spiritual journey about 14 years ago, there was a lot of darkness in my life. But as soon as I started that journey, I started to make a lot of changes within myself and recognize the importance and the value of women. As First Nations men, we hold women above us because the reality is they're much more powerful than us. They have that ability to create life. Children are everything to us, our current children and our future generations. It's the reason we work so hard and we do the things that we do so that we can provide a life for the children better than we had. Many, many years ago, you know, when they started the residential schools, violence towards women and children may at a small degree been prevalent with our people, but it's not like it is now. It was taught to us in residential schools that, you know, violence and all of that negativity was normal. It is not normal. I've worked at the elementary level. I've worked at the high school level. Now I work at CNC. And as a ceremonial pipe carrier and a sun dancer, I've actually made a lifelong commitment to what you said, keep those doors open and point our men in a positive direction so that we can break that cycle of that violence and that intergenerational trauma. You know, I'd humbly state this, but I've helped a lot of men and women in positions that I've held in the past, and a lot of them have moved on to live really good lives now, clean and sober lives, and that effect is going to pass on to their children and their grandchildren, and so on and so on. I really believe in that ripple effect. So long after I'm gone, I'd like to think that something I may have said or done or pointed somebody in a direction that it affected the future generations. I'm just a regular human being, you know, and I'm able to pass on what I've learned from my elders and my Sundance leaders. I owe it all to them, so I'm just paying it forward.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This is a CHY News Update. It's official. Nanaimo now holds the record for the world's largest Nanaimo bar. Over the weekend, the scent of butter, custard, chocolate, and of course coconut hung in the air at the Nanaimo campus of Vancouver Island University as students in the Culinary Arts and Professional Baking and Pastry Arts program unveiled a record-breaking 70-foot-long Nanaimo bar. On Saturday, May 17th, thousands of people squeezed into the Windsor Plywood Trades Discovery Center to get a look and a taste of the Nanaimo bar that stretched about the same length as the center. Before the event, CHY spoke with Aaron Weber, chairperson of the VIU Professional Baking and Pastry Arts Program. He says the idea to build the world's largest Nanaimo bar has been in the works for several years now.
It was actually a project that was sort of dreamed up from some students that were in our baking diploma program the inaugural year. We were looking at ideas to promote a business or school or something like for like an opening, and we decided to look up world records, and as you know, being in Nanaimo, we decided to check that out. And we were a little shocked that the record doesn't lie in Nanaimo. It's actually, and quite honestly, if the record was in Nanaimo, I don't think we'd be pursuing this.
Weber says that a Nanaimo bar is an iconic dessert in Nanaimo and across the country.
If you ask people what Canadian food is, or even like desserts, is even more limited, I would say, but there's not like things that are resonate with Canadian cuisine. And you know, the Nanaimo bar is something that we can claim as our own, and I think it's pretty cool that it's actually from, you know, a small community like this.
He says the students started creating the bar 4 days before the official event, and that creating the Nanaimo bar is a great project for the students.
These are kind of the memorable things that throughout your career you look back on, and you might not remember that day today when you're making croissants or bread in the kitchen, but you'll remember that day that you're making all those Nanaimo bars and serving that. So, and that's actually, it's one of the fantastic things about being a chef or a baker is we have these opportunities to create like amazing things that that can, you know, be a community event like that we're doing on Saturday. So
the event was also a fundraiser for the culinary programs to purchase new ovens.
Our ovens are fantastic. They're just well loved, and they are getting sort of towards the end of life. So, and quite often this seems to be the case, like in kitchens, like when one thing starts going, they all start going. So we are in need of our main bread oven for down here in the baking program. But we also need an oven upstairs for the pastry kitchen as well. So our hope is to replace those two main ovens with this project.
On Saturday, Weber told CHY that the experience of bringing the jumbo bar together has been amazing.
Yes, what a great team effort. I was very confident in the team that we could pull this off, but now that it's on the table and we've seen it come to life, just so proud of everybody involved. So yeah, it's been a great process and so much fun to do.
For some stats, the Nanaimo bar ended up being 70 feet long, 32 inches wide, 1,200 pounds, and 2.4 million calories. In comparison, the Nanaimo bar is about half the size of the Hello ferry that travels from downtown Nanaimo to downtown Vancouver. The ferry clocks in at about an overall length of 42.2 meters, or about 138 feet. The previous record holding Nanaimo bar was only 8 feet long, 44 inches wide, and 530 pounds, which was made in 2020 in Levack, Ontario. The new record-breaking length for the bar, made in its namesake, was certified by both the Baking Association of Canada and the Culinary Federation of Canada, which represents the VIU trade students. To acknowledge the day, Nanaimo Mayor Leonard Croke spoke to the hungry crowd and proclaimed May 17th as Nanaimo Bar Day.
Friends, we are really lucky to live in this amazing community where we have this kind of enthusiasm, and I can only say it's only right and proper that we host the creation of the biggest Nanaimo bar in the history of the planet. It is not the Victoria Bar. It is not the Saskatoon Bar. It is not the Ottawa Bar. It is the Nanaimo Bar.
Once the bar was cut into almost 4,000 pieces, lines stretched around the Discovery Center as people waited to get a bite out of the record-breaking moment. And once people got to try the bar, it was fair to say it was a delicious, record-breaking moment.
How is it?
It is fantastic.
Really
very
good.
Sweet.
Yeah.
And a lot better than I anticipated.
Yeah. Do you guys normally like Nanaimo bars?
We do.
We do.
Normally have like a little piece because it's so sweet normally time, but this, they nailed it. They nailed the custard and the chocolate and very
and
good.
And we just moved here a few months ago. This is our first one here.
Yeah.
So how's that for perfect?
What an introduction to the environment, right?
Yeah.
And the community, having a Nanaimo bar.
Yeah.
I tried it. It tastes pretty good. I didn't expect the piece to be that big, but it's pretty huge.
The VIU stamp of approval on it, too.
That's like a $5 Nanaimo bar.
Yeah, easily.
It's great. And it's creamy and delicious and rich.
I'd say for how big it is, it's one of the best ones I've ever had.
It's delicious.
It's really good. Delicious.
So awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. Thank you so much.
Really well balanced, I think.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Would you like to say how you thought?
Oh, you haven't tried it yet.
Oh, no, I'm eating his. This, I'm taking this home to my mom in Campbell River.
Smart.
She got the authentic one, too.
No, it's my first Nanaimo bar. Yeah, so it's good. It's got a nice taste, and it's nice. I like it. Yeah, but it's sweet for me.
Too sweet? That's fair.
Yeah, yeah, but it's good. I like it, yeah. And it's fun being part of such a crowd and support the students, so it's good. Yeah, I like it.
It's awesome. It tastes great.
Would you like to say anything?
It's pretty good, yeah.
Perfect. Great. Thank you so much.
Well, event goers were encouraged to grab a second piece in exchange for a donation to the culinary program. Any Nanaimo bars that were left over were packaged up, frozen, and donated to the Salvation Army in Nanaimo. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This is CICK News. A Haida fisher made a discovery in a Chinook salmon that he caught last week, which had an acoustic tag inside its belly, marking the first salmon caught in a project called Bottleneck to Survival. This project is led by PhD candidate Wesley Greentree, who you'll hear from on today's show. That salmon was the first of 329 Chinook as part of Wesley's project, which he will share the details on right now.
Hi, I'm Wesley Greentree. I'm a PhD student at the University of Victoria. I work with Pacific Salmon Foundation and its partners to understand the migrations of Chinook salmon in the ocean.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me. Now, the reason why I contacted you was because the Council of the Haida Nation had posted on Facebook that one of their fishers found one of your tagged salmon from a project called Bottlenecks to Survival Project. So could you start by telling me about that project?
So the Bottlenecks to Survival Project is a big project with a lot of different people involved where we're all interested in salmon and trying to understand why salmon populations have declined over the last several decades. So the project is led by Pacific Salmon Foundation and BC Conservation Foundation, and it brings together Vancouver Island First Nations, the province of BC, as well as Fisheries Oceans Canada. And then we get to have all these other really interesting collaborations that come up. So for example, today I'm talking about this Chinook salmon that was caught off of Haida Gwaii by a Haida fisher. And so we got to work with the Council of the Haida Nation to understand a little bit more about this fish. And so the Bottlenecks to Survival Project started in 2020, and then we've started to track the migration of salmon since October of 2022.
And so your method for tracking this information is using acoustic tags. So can you describe what an acoustic tag is?
So when we want to track fish in the ocean, we can't use GPS because GPS signals don't travel through water very well. And so instead, similar to how whales communicate over really long distances using their voice, we put in these small electronic tags that produce very high pitch signals that are audible, but not to the human ear or to the fish themselves that tell us where our fish are in the ocean. So we are able to go catch salmon when they're pretty young. They're less than 1 year old. And so for two birth years of salmon, we went and tagged some that had just entered the ocean and then tracked their movements around. As part of the bigger project, the Bottlenecks to Survival Project, we tag salmon from the time that they're just baby salmon, which we call fry, all the way until they're just about to return back to their home river to spawn.
And so you're interested in the migration pattern of Chinook salmon for the purpose of this program, but what's unique about Chinook salmon migration patterns? And do all Chinook perform the same type of migration pattern as well?
That's a really great question. Chinook salmon are, if you don't know, they're the largest salmon, and they're also the one that lives the longest of the Pacific salmon. They do all sorts of different migration patterns, and this actually makes them really interesting to study, because within fish that are related, you know, they're from the same river, they might go to completely different places in the ocean. One fish might stay really close to its home river, you know, migrating less than 100 kilometers over its life, while another might migrate as far as Alaska. It's really important to understand these migration patterns because these fish are ending up in all sorts of different places along the coast of North America.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then what do those migration patterns, what do they affect in so far as population dynamics, life history, evolution, and connections of animals to natural ecosystems and even humans?
So that's the entire goal of my PhD, is to understand that those types of questions. Where salmon go in the ocean affects two things that have broader consequences. First, where they go in the ocean affects the types of predators or the types of fisheries that they interact with. And so there's certain places that are just more dangerous to be a salmon in the ocean. The second is that where salmon migrate in the ocean affects the type of food that they have access to. And so some places have tons of really abundant, really nutritious food for salmon to eat, while other places, it's a lot more difficult for salmon to get the food that they need to be able to swim fast away from predators.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And what about, yeah, what has this taught you about the connections of animals to natural ecosystems? Do you feel like you're learning anything about the way that humans farm or fish salmon as well, especially Chinook salmon?
I think this is one of the really cool parts of this project, is that these fish that we've tagged, so we tagged them in Comox, which is off of Vancouver Island in southern British Columbia. These fish migrate thousands of kilometers, so they connect ecosystems from, you know, southern BC near Vancouver all the way up to Alaska. And in this case, one of the fish that we tagged was caught by a Haida fisher off of the north end of Haida Gwaii. This is this really incredible opportunity for us to understand where these fish are moving and how they interact with both different ecosystems as well as different communities.
Mm-hmm. Has anything surprised you since you began this project that you just couldn't have really predicted about the patterns of these Chinook salmon?
Yes. This seems to be the case with every time that we try and track fish and see where they migrate, is that something bizarre happens always. The one that was most surprising to me is that a lot of Chinook salmon from the Strait of Georgia are homebodies. We often think of salmon as migrating incredibly far distances. Some salmon migrate as far as Russia and Japan. But of the fish that we track, many of them stayed really close to where they were tagged, sometimes for multiple years.
Thank you to Wesley Greentree, PhD candidate from the University of Victoria, for sharing your Chinook salmon research project with us, Bottlenecks to Survival. And that's this week's episode of The Scoop, a podcast and broadcast featuring stories from remote BC by the journalists in the communities of Smithers, Cortez Island, Revelstoke, Kootenay, Prince George, and Terrace. This program was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program. Tune in next week for another episode and follow us online wherever you get your podcasts.
Good day. You're tuned into Free